Thank you. It's very nice to be here in Santa Barbara once again. Okay, so back in 1995, Polchinski told us that D brains are important for non-perturbative effects in string theory. Okay, so we really had to learn what D brains were. Now, D brain, as I'm sure you heard last week, if you hadn't heard already, a D brain is where an open string ends. So in that sense, it's to be thought of somehow as a subspace of the target space. I'm always going to use the notation X for the target space. And for most of these talks, if not all of them, the X is going to be a Calabi-Yau threefold. Now, this immediately raised a problem, especially for those of us who worked on things like mirror symmetry. And that is that the notion of a subspace well, let's call it a submanifold in the case of a smooth target space. In a sense, this is poorly defined in string theory. And the reason is as follows, is that I can begin on some target space X, which is nice and big, and I can think of something which looks like a subspace, e.g. pick a four cycle. And then I can look at the moduli space of all my spaces X, and I can go around a big loop in that moduli space, which will correspond to starting off with a big X, making X fairly small, and then going back to a big X again. So this is like going around a loop in a moduli space. And lo and behold, if I follow formally what I thought was a four cycle, it can turn into a two cycle, for example. So this raised the problem. If I was supposed to think of D brains as being somehow subspaces, and that they were key objects for me to understand the non-perturbative effects of string theory, how can the notion of a D-brain be consistent with this kind of monodromy? How can a four-cycle turn into a two-cycle? Now, the point of these talks is to give a fairly explicit picture of exactly what's of the mechanism that goes on here, of indeed how a four-cycle does turn into a two-cycle in some sense. So that's going to be the main purpose of these talks. And it's going to take me all four talks to get to the monodromy aspect. Now, the next thing I should say is that there's a vast literature on D-brains. Probably more work has been done on D-brains than on anything else in strings over the last 5 or 6 years. I'm going to follow a very narrow path. And I'm going to be following a program that's pretty much due to Michael Douglas. And this is a program that I guess can be traced back to a paper by Brunner, Douglas, Lawrence, and Rummelsberger. And then Mike has written various papers by himself and with other people. Let me just list some more names. Jackanescu, Goodness, etc. So this is the program that I'm going to follow. So in particular, most of the stuff I'm going to talk about is certainly not work that I've done. There'll be a little bit here and there which I did, but most of it's actually thanks to Mike. and various other papers have been key in this. There's, for example, a paper by Hori Iqbal and Dafa, and Uguri, Oz, and Yin. But this represents a very small fraction of all the work that's been done on D-brains. Most of the stuff that people have been doing on D-brains has been in space which is flat. And just to give you some idea about this, there's a huge paper written by Clifford Johnson, which are based on various lectures he gave, which is HET 007170. And I can't remember the length of this paper by Clifford, but it's many hundreds of pages long, I seem to remember. And almost nothing that I'm going to talk about will have any overlap whatsoever with the stuff in this paper. Okay. So D-brains really is a huge subject. Okay, well, building D-brains on a Calabi-Yau will take about 7 steps. And let me roughly number these steps as follows. First of all, I'm going to build a conformal field theory of closed strings. Next thing we're going to do is to twist to a topological quantum field theory. Topological quantum field theory. Next thing I'm going to do is to add boundaries. To the world sheet. In a sense, this is going to be adding 1 D-brain. Then we're going to add more than 1 D-brain. Then we're going to remove physical grading dependence. This will make no sense whatsoever until I actually get to the point. The 6th step is going to be deformed to the derived category. Of coherent sheaves. And the 7th step is going to be to analyze the, let's say, the non-topological quantum field theory aspects. And in particular, the notion of stability. Okay. So, hopefully this is going to take me four talks. The first talk is going to be roughly these 3 things. Now, I'm going to be really sketchy in the first talk. I mean, there's a problem whenever you talk about strings, especially to people from the math world, is that you really do need to bring in quantum field theory. And I can't do this. I can't give you a good overview of the subject in one talk and explain everything. So I'm going to be horribly sketchy, which will upset many of you. But I'm sorry, but this is the only way that I can do it. So this is just going to be a sketch for the first 3 things. The next one I'll be able to go a little bit more detail, and that's going to be talk 2. And this last aspect is going to be the last 2 talks. In a sense, it's the most interesting aspect, those last 2 things. So actually, I think mathematicians may find that these talks get more satisfying as they go on. You'll be most upset by the first talk, and then things which will gradually get better. Now, let me also point out from the very start that there are 2 different kinds of D-brains that I'm going to be interested in. Which are called A-brains and D-brains. A-brains, B-brains. and as we'll see, the A brains correspond to 3 cycles in X. And the B brains, in some sense, correspond to even cycles in X. Now, our area of interest, the aim of these talks, is to describe B brains. That's what I'm going to be focusing on. However, it will be useful at various times to exploit the existence of these things. So I'm going to say that we're going to exploit these, and we're going to study these. Now, studying A brains to the same extent that I'm going to study B brains is a very difficult subject, and I think it's fair to say that we don't really understand A brains half as well as we understand B brains, but I'm still going to be able to use A brains at various points in the talk to help me with knowledge of B brains. But this is where our focus is going to be. Let me just reference the other people. I'm always very bad at referencing people, so let me try and get the references over with. Gives me a better chance of not omitting names I should. On this last point here, we're going to be discussing aspects of monodromy. And this is going to tie our work into some old ideas by Konsevich and allow us to, in a sense, prove a conjecture by Horscher and Morrison. And it's also going to be tied in with work by Seidel and Thomas. So that's going to happen in the last talk, that I'll be able to tie it all into this stuff. Okay. So what I'm going to begin with is the type 2A or type 2B superstring. And this is a, basically it's an n equals 2 theory of supersymmetry in 10 space-time dimensions. Now I can take this theory, which is essentially a 10-dimensional theory, and I can compactify it on Minkowski 4 space times my Calabi-Yau threefold X. And then in this Minkowski 4 space, I now have an effective n equals 2 theory supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So there are 2 theories in space-time that we'll be dealing with. One is the n equals 2 supersymmetry in 10 dimensions. One's an n equals 2 theory in 4 dimensions. And a soliton is a background field configuration which satisfies the equation of motion. And I could think of this field theory as living in either 4 dimensions or in 10 dimensions, or 4 or 10 dimensions. Now, a special kind of soliton is a BPS soliton, which is invariant under one of the 2 supersymmetries. Okay? So in either, both in 4 dimensions and in 10 dimensions, I've got 2 supersymmetries, so I can have a BPS soliton either 4 dimensions or 10 dimensions, which is invariant under exactly one of them. Okay. And these are the things that we're going to be interested in. In particular, a D brain is such a BPS soliton. Now, the way you think of this D-brain as a BPS soliton, as I said, we're going to think of a D-brain as somehow being a subspace. Now, a soliton has an energy density. The energy of a soliton is always, roughly speaking, constrained to live in a certain subspace of the target space. So just think of the soliton as being a as a background where the energy density is somehow concentrated around some subspace, and that subspace is going to be the D-brain. Right, well, so in this language, a D-brain is not going to be literally a subspace, it's going to be somewhat blurred, which would make things smooth. So this is the soliton story of what a This, in a sense, is how you explain what a D-brain is in terms of the target space theory. But the alternative view of what a D-brain is the world sheet point of view, where, as I said, you think of it as being where as where an open string ends. So now let's go onto the world sheet and try and describe things from there. So, in a sense, I'm going to start at item one in this list. So I'm going to consider maps of a Riemann surface. At the moment, this is a Riemann surface with no boundary. Let me write down my one big equation for the whole thing, I think. And the action is given by so what I'm writing down is a thing called the nonlinear sigma model. IJKL. And this is the action for it. So I have a definite. So, this is our quantum field theory, which lives on the two-dimensional world sheet and describes the map phi, here's our field phi, phi into the target space X, where my uppercase letters, so IJ, go from 1 to 6. These are the real coordinates. And of more interest, to make a supersymmetric theory, I've added in some more fields which I've called psi, along with these phis, which are fermions. So psi li, psi ri are fermions. Particular, psi l is a section of the square root of the canonical bundle times the pullback of the tangent bundle of x. And psi r is a section of the anti-canonical bundle square root. Okay. And by adding these two fermions, these two species of fermions, I've given myself lots of supersymmetry. In my two-dimensional field theory. Okay. Right, I haven't mentioned what Bij is. So Gij is the metric. Bij is an anti-symmetric tensor so I can associate to it a real 2 form, and indeed to satisfy the equations of motion I'm going to assume it's closed. Okay. Now this B called the B field is going to be very useful at some point. Let's ignore it for the time being. We'll certainly come back to it soon. At the moment, let's just think of the only degree of freedom really being the metric, G. I should explain one more bit of notation. This uppercase D, this is the, let me just give an example for this guy. This is the, if you like, some kind of covariance notion of a derivative on the world sheet, which is got by pulling back the Levi-Chebyshev connection on the target space. So I've got that kind of statement.
Well, that's a pretty severe restriction.
Absolutely, but I'm choosing to do that. I mean, for example, if I did include non-trivial H, then I'd need to have a dilaton in here too. So. This is a nice subset of theories which is easy to deal with. But absolutely. Absolutely, sure. I'm choosing to make H0 for these talks, but I agree that it would be nice if I didn't have to impose that. Let me also add at this point, but for these talks, I'm doing something rather strange. I'm actually going to rely pretty much entirely on the world sheet point of view of strings. Now, the whole point about doing D-brains arose after 1995 when we realized that things could be non-perturbative in the string coupling, which would be very important. I'm going to completely ignore that fact. I'm going to rely totally on the world sheet point of view. So my string coupling is essentially zero for these entire talks. It's as if I'm doing a pre-1995 talk, even though I'm talking about D-brains. So I'm going to rely heavily on the world sheet picture. Sure, but I mean, but the fashion after 1995 was to not do things totally on the world sheet, but I am doing things totally on the world sheet now. There are some interesting operators in this field theory. Again, this is why I have to be sketchy. I'm going to use the machinery of quantum field theory, even though I don't have time to explain things properly. So I'm going to pull in operators. If you don't understand quantum field theory properly, just think of these as some functions which live on the world sheet. Okay, now what I've done here is I've exploited now the fact that my target space, I'm going to do a common error throughout this. I'm going to be, if I ever write an uppercase X, I probably mean an uppercase phi. Okay, X is the target space, phi is the map going to it, where Gij bar is the Kähler metric. Right, so the uppercase I's and J's are going to be the real numbers, which they're the real things which go from 1 to 6. My lowercase I's and I's, I bars are complex things which are going to run from 1 to 3. So I've switched from using real coordinates here down to complex coordinates here. So I, J, etc. run from 1 to 3, and they can be barred to denote the anti-holomorphic coordinates. Is the Kähler metric required for the n equals 2 comma 2 supersymmetry? I mean, it was one thing for me to add enough fermions to possibly have n equals 2 comma 2 supersymmetry, but to actually have the n equals 2 comma 2 supersymmetry, I need the target space to be Kähler. Where psi I, so a real, sorry, a lowercase index means that this lives in the pullback. So rather than just the pullback of the tangent bundle, I mean the pullback of the holomorphic tangent bundle, which I could write as 1 comma 0, for example. Okay. So that's what a lowercase index on psi means. Now these interesting operators I've written down here, these are the generators of the worldsheet supersymmetry. So there they are. There are two left-moving ones and two right-moving ones. Hence the notation n equals 2 comma 2. So those are some of the operators that we're going to be interested in. There are so-called U1 currents, which come for free once you have n equals 2 supersymmetry. And I'm going to call these JL and JR for the left-moving one and the right-moving one. And these things allow me to associate a charge, both left-moving and right-moving, to any observable, to any operator in my quantum field theory. So let me expand that a little bit. Actually, any operator has, well, as well as a charge, it also has what's called a conformal weight. Which simply measures how the operator changes when you rescale the worldsheet. And indeed, it has a left-moving conformal weight and a right-moving conformal weight, which I'll refer to as H and H bar. And it also has, as I said there, a U1 charge, both left-moving and right-moving. So if I were to give a series of talks rather than just one talk on the basic setup of conformal field theory, I could go into detail as to exactly how this works. But instead, let me just tell you that there's some black box by which I can, for any operator, I can calculate what its weight is and what its U1 charge is. If it's an eigenstate of those operators, I mean, obviously I could take two operators of different weights and I could add them and then there'd be an indefinite weight. But think of operators as being somehow eigenstates of these weight and charge operators. These are the eigenvalues that you get under those two operators. So this is the basic setup of the world sheet picture of maps of a Riemann surface with no boundary mapping into our target space X. Now, so far I've mentioned only world sheet supersymmetry. At n equals 2, 2, supersymmetry on the world sheet with these psis introduced as fermions on the world sheet. I've made no mention so far of supersymmetry on the target space. And supersymmetry on the target space is a different concept to supersymmetry on the world sheet. But they are tied in with each other. And the way that they're tied in with each other is that if I have n equals 2 supersymmetry on the world sheet, I can then construct a supersymmetry on the target space if I can construct the following operator. So here's yet another weird field that I'm writing down, where omega ijk is a 3, 0 form on X. So in particular, if this is the Calabi-Yau condition guarantees its existence, both exists and is non-vanishing. And it's this operator, it's this thing here, which generates my target space supersymmetry, which indeed is why I insist that the target space is a has got vanishing first-gen class. All I needed was the target space to be Kähler to have world sheet n equals 2, 2 supersymmetry. For target space supersymmetry, I also want this operator. Sometimes goes by the name of spectral flow operator. Now, I've written SL. This, of course, there's an SR that goes along with it. If I just replace my L's by R's, I get another one. And that's not surprising. It means I have n equals 2 target space supersymmetry. I've got two supersymmetries in my target space, both the SL and the SR. So ditto for SR. So again, I really don't have time, unfortunately, to go into the details of this, but roughly the idea of the way this works is if I have some operator which corresponds to a space-time boson, say, I can take an operator product of that boson with this thing, and actually I need to add in a bit some more things to represent the space-time part of it. This just represents the x part. I have to add a thing called the spinner field in R1, 3. If I take an operator product of this thing with something that represents a space-time boson, I'll get a space-time fermion. If I take a product of this operator with a space-time fermion, it'll take me back to a space-time boson. Okay. So that's the way it represents the space-time supersymmetry. Okay. So now let us try and introduce the D-brains. I'm going to introduce a boundary on the world sheet. And I'm going to try and make it a D-brain, i.e. I'm going to try and make it a BPS state by keeping one of these space-time supersymmetries. Add a boundary to the world sheet. Well, there are two basic boundary conditions that I can impose on the world sheet. Either I can impose that the derivative with respect to sigma vanishes, or with respect to tau vanishes, where sigma So sigma goes along the string. So I have a string which starts at sigma equals 0 and goes to sigma equals pi. That's the variable that runs along the string. And tau is time running in the other direction. So this first boundary condition is a Neumann boundary condition. And the second boundary condition is a Dirichlet boundary condition. Now the D in D-brain stands for Dirichlet. This is going to represent the D-brain if I impose this condition. This condition just means that the end of the string is free and is allowed to wiggle around anywhere. This means that the end of the string is stuck somewhere, which is going to be my D-brain. Now, my world sheet coordinate was sigma plus I tau. So if I replace sigma and tau by z and obviously z bar, then I guess for the Neumann, if I've got my signs right, I get that d phi is minus d bar phi, or for Dirichlet, I get that d phi is plus d bar phi. So these are the two boundaries that I can impose on my world sheet in terms of holomorphic coordinates on the world sheet. So in general, a single D-brain will impose some coordinate like some condition like this, where R is a matrix with eigenvalues plus 1 or minus 1. And the eigenvalues, which are plus 1, if I've got my signs right, are the directions where I've imposed a Dirichlet boundary condition. So those are the directions which are normal to my D-brain. Those are directions where I'm literally ending on the D-brain. And the eigenvalues, which are minus 1, correspond to directions which are going, which are staying within the D-brain. They're the boundary conditions which are free. Okay. So if I look at R, I can tell how many dimensions the D-brain is filling by looking at the number of eigenvalues, which are plus 1. Okay. Oops, I just pulled down the same one. Now, d by dz of phi is related to psi l by supersymmetry. And so this condition which I've imposed for the for the derivatives of psi must also be true for the fields psi. Oops. For both L and R. So for both psi L, no, hang on, put the law. D by d phi is related to psi L, d bar psi is related to psi R I. That's the way it works. Okay. So I have really that psi L I equals R I J psi R L. Okay. Okay. Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to impose a D-brain. I'd like to put a D-brain in the system in such a way that I preserve one of my two supersymmetries. Now, you can see that I'm going to have to break at least some of the supersymmetry, because what this boundary is doing is that it's telling me that there is a relationship between the left-moving fermions and the right-moving fermions. That's what the boundary condition has done. It's mixed up the notion of depending on Z with the notion of depending on Z bar. Now, my two supersymmetries have been written in terms of psi L's, and the other one was written in terms of psi R's. So I've somehow mixed these two supersymmetries together. And that's what's going to mean that the best I can do is to just be left with one supersymmetry rather than both supersymmetries after I've imposed this boundary. Right, the space-time supersymmetry, which is this guy. Okay. Now, the Wall-Tooth supersymmetry has also been broken down from n equals 2, 2 to n equals 2. Okay. So I'm breaking both the Wall-Tooth supersymmetry down and the space-time supersymmetry. So, how can I extract one good space-time supersymmetry from this way I've mixed up the left movers and the right movers by imposing a boundary on the world sheet? Well, what I need to do is I need to take my n equals 2, 2 world sheet supersymmetry. I had two supersymmetries moving in one direction, i.e. a function of z, and I had two other supersymmetries moving in the other direction, i.e. a function of z bar. And I need to combine them to give me one good n equals 2 world sheet supersymmetry, which will give me my one good target space supersymmetry. In other words, I need to use the boundary to, in some sense, identify the two into one. I realize I'm not being that rigorous here, but this is just a hand-waving argument for how to get this. Okay. Now, there are two ways of doing this. Let me write down the second one first. They're called A and B. If you remember, I had currents moving both leftwards and rightwards. I had my JL and JR. The easy thing to do is to just set them equal to each other. Let's say that they're equal, and say that the left-moving supersymmetry is a constant times the right-moving space-time supersymmetry. That's the obvious thing to do, is to impose these two constraints somehow, and that'll guarantee me that I've got my one last, my one space-time supersymmetry left. But actually, I could, there's no reason why I can't put a minus sign in there. I could say that the left-moving current is actually minus the right-moving current. Now, changing the sign of the world sheet current is actually like taking a complex conjugate in target space. If you follow through my notation, you'll notice that. The pluses and minuses, which I put on my G plus and G minus, relate to I's and I's bars in just the right way. So actually, in a sense, if I'm going to flip the sign of that current, I need to, in some sense, take the complex conjugate of the right-moving spectral flow operator. So I claim if I impose either that condition, I'm going to salvage one of my target space supersymmetries. I should mention, by the way, I'm basically following an argument that's due to Uguri, Olsen, Yin, which was written back in 1996, I think. So what does this give us? What do we actually get in terms of, say, the metric if we try and impose these constraints on the world sheet? Well, let me first of all impose that my B field is going to be zero. So I'm going to ignore this for the time being, but it's only going to come back soon. If I do set this field I call B equal to zero, then it's fairly easy to prove that JL equals. I'm sorry? Yeah, okay, yeah, that's true. So, but I had earlier said I was setting the B field to zero. So, I'm maintaining the B field at zero. I'm going to flip my minus sign in here. And the best way to think of this is to take the Kähler form and think of it as a symplectic form rather than a Kähler form. I mean, a Kähler form is just a special case of a symplectic form. It's a block form where if I write my matrix basically so that it is plus or minus one going down the diagonal, I get a zero for the minus one eigenvalues, and a zero for the plus eigenvalues mixing with each other, and I can put something in here which is like one, something here which is like minus one. So it's not difficult to show that that's how the symplectic form has to act if I'm going to impose this. Remember, my key equation that I'm implicitly solving here was that psi L I equals psi R I J, psi R I, and J L, for example, was G I J. This is where the metric's coming in. Okay. So you can see that I'm going to impose some condition on the metric, because the metric is included in J. So this is what happens. And this implies, of course, that my D brain is Lagrangian. Pretty much the definition of Lagrangian. My symplectic form is vanishing along the directions of the Lagrangian subspace. And then the second condition, that SL is a constant times SR bar, it's not hard to show that that the D brain is actually special Lagrangian. In other words, the real part and the actual, well, there's a phase. The phase is hidden in whatever constant you chose. Yeah.
Well, shouldn't
we replace by J? Absolutely, yes. And that one should be, yes. Oh, yeah, this is Kähler as well. Sorry about that. Comes in the, there you go. Is that better? So the real part of e to the I phi omega is the volume form, and the imaginary part of e to the I phi omega is zero. And the exact choice of what this phi is arbitrary, because it was hidden in this constant, which could be anything. So this is my so-called... Well, you just write things locally in terms of z's and z-bars, and you'll find that the Lagrangian... Sorry? Yeah, I mean, if you just break things down into z's and z-bars, you'll find that the volume form is a holomorphic volume form, so long as you restrict to the special Lagrangian. I'm not sure if I can reconstruct the argument exactly on the blackboard, but just writing down this condition. See, it's basically, Lagrangian doesn't imply special Lagrangian. You've got to get the Z and Z bars working right. But that's exactly what you get by imposing this condition here. This is the omega, and this is omega bar.
And you...
Well, I definitely, but the existence of, well, I certainly need the condition to get that omega could possibly be a volume form. So I agree, but I definitely need that condition. Yeah. Once I've said that omega exists, then I must have used other condition. Omega doesn't exist if the target space isn't a Calabi-Yau. Right. Right, right. Yeah, right. Oh, okay, sure. Yeah. If I write down, if I rotate so that my matrix R literally looks like minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, and plus 1, plus 1, plus 1 down the diagonal, then this is the form that the metric will then take in that basis. only very close to the D-brain that I'm looking at. Yeah, I mean, all these statements are local. I'm choosing a local patch in my manifold and then writing the metric in that form. Yeah, which is true if the B field is zero, I think. Oh, right. Well, I've even mentioned field strength yet. At the moment, yeah, I haven't turned on any field strength on the D-brain because I don't have a field yet. Okay, I mean in general that I haven't fixed the plus one and minus ones to be on the diagonal. I get that just from the fact that the Kähler form is a non-degenerate form now tells me that. Okay, in order for this to be non-degenerate, it must be true that this is half the dimension. So that follows.
Is there proof that there are no other boundary conditions?
I'm not going to put my hand on my heart and say no. Okay, yeah. That doesn't surprise me.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just writing down the simplest possible things here, which I'm going to play with. So the other choice was where. I guess that's what I'm not involved in this. Well, I can turn on the B field and the field strength of the D-brain, which said I'm explicitly not doing that. But okay. Yeah, I haven't included these degrees of freedom yet, so at the moment what I'm saying is true. Okay, so for the B type ones, you again can go to a patch of the manifold and you can locally analyze what the metric must be doing. And it's not difficult to show that the D-brain is an even dimensional subspace. Basically, this matrix, I'm going to exchange where the zeros and ones are. And then the non-degeneracy tells me it must be an even-dimensional subspace. And then this condition here tells me that it must be embedded as a complex submanifold. Okay, so that's the analog of special Lagrangian in a case of B. Oh, that might be true, yeah. Yeah. That might be true. This might imply both, and this might give nothing. That might be true. I can't remember the details of which. Definitely both of these conditions imply these two conditions. Exactly how they break up, I can't quite remember the details. Okay. Okay. I won't argue with that. The statement I just want is that the A brain is a special Lagrangian submanifold and the B brain is a complex submanifold. And our focus, as I said earlier, is going to be the B type. It's the things which look like complex submanifolds, so the things that we're really interested in. But it's going to be useful at various times to exploit some of the properties of the A brain. Now, at the moment, a D brain is literally a submanifold. Now, there's a bit more to it than that, as has been alluded to. We ignored the B field. So let's consider more closely what this this two-form BIJ is actually doing here. Consider first closed strings. We have for a map. So this is our map of our Riemann surface into our target space. Basically, B gives a phase to the path integral. This is the way that B is actually sat in the action. The way I wrote B in the action is actually just a pullback of the target space B onto the world sheet. That's the form that it appeared in the action. So the exponential of the action is just the phase that I associate to the path integral. So this is what the B field's doing. Now, since I've got the exponential of 2 pi I, if I change B by an element of the integral two forms, I'm not going to change what this phase is. So actually, what B really is, it's an element of the second cohomology with values in U1. That's where we should really think of B. Okay. This is my version of B. in fact, I might be about to say what was mentioned last week then. So let me go backwards a bit and just think of this as a Durham 2 form, then at least if the cohomology of my target space is torsion free, then I can just say that this thing is the same as this if I identify B with B plus gamma for gamma a integer 2 form. So I can approximate B with a 2 form like that, and B is also equivalent to B plus the lambda for lambda is a 1 form. So did you do gerbs last week?
Gerbs?
Yeah.
Gerbs,
oh, okay. Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to just mention briefly that what B actually is, this second condition here, you can think of as some kind of gauge invariance. And what the B field is really, it's not really a two-form, B is really, should really be considered to be a flat gerb. No, sorry, B should be considered a connection on a flat gerb. A flat connection on a gerb. Flat connection on a gerb. Sorry? It doesn't have to be flat, but the condition that I said that B was a closed two form, I'm restricting myself just to simple models. So let me just say that B is flat. It's exactly the same thing as saying that H, the field strength of B is zero. I'm just imposing that to make life simple for myself. Because I'm assuming it. I want to make life easy for myself. Okay. Now this gauge invariance, or if you want to use the fancy language, this identification of B as something to do with a gerb, is going to break down as soon as I include a boundary. Okay. This is all working fine if I had a world sheet with no boundary. But if sigma has a boundary, or boundaries, this gauge invariance is broken. Unless we include some boundary terms in the phase, so I'm going to add into the phase something to do with the boundary. Where A, so when B shifts like this, I can compensate for it by just taking that lambda off A. That's going to restore my gauge invariance. So A is a one form on the boundary. But it's not really a one form on the boundary. If I say that B is a flat connection on a gerb, what A really is, A is a connection on a bundle over the boundary. So it's, well, that's what I'm going to say. In order for me to have some notion of gauge invariance, which is considered a good thing in string theory, to have this identification of B as being something to do with a gerb, I must put some kind of line bundle over my D brains to restore this gauge invariance. So a D brain isn't just a subspace. In string theory, we add onto it at least some line bundle, so. We've got to add on at least a line bundle. We're free to add on more than that. I mean, I can define whatever I want to be the degrees of freedom of a string. But to make things nice and to maintain this gerb-like structure, I need to put at least a line bundle over my D-brain. Okay. So the natural thing to do, Since B was a connection B is a flat connection on a, well, let me call it a U1 gerb. It's an abelian gerb. Then the natural thing for A would be a flat connection on a U1 bundle. And we put a question mark after it. Okay. The obvious thing I would want to do would be to put a flat connection on a U1 bundle. Now, I said I'm free to put more than that on the D brain, and indeed, I often will. So, in particular, it's not going to be a U1 bundle, it's going to be a UN bundle, when we think of the U1 as just being a diagonal part of UN, so.
It's not quite a U1 bundle, it's a trivialization of the gerb.
Oh, really? Well, that's interesting. There's some sense in which it's right. Okay, I'll have to gloss over that point then. I'm just trying to. Okay. In a naive sense, it's a bundle. If it's not really a bundle, then I better change everything so it's not really a bundle. But that's something which should be done.
See, the analog is supposing you take everything 1 degree down, and you try to take a one form that you think of as a connection on a circle bundle, and instead of integrating over a circle, which is like a closed circle, do it over an interval. Well, that's parallel transport. But to make it a number, what do? You trivialize the bundle of the end points, and you can make parallel transport. And this is the analog.
Okay, so this might need to be tweaked somewhat to make it sensible. But in the spirit of my rough overview I'm giving in this talk, I just wanted to motivate why I want a line bundle on the end of my string. Okay, now. That's true. Well, that's not necessarily true. But at least when B is zero, it's a U1 bundle. Okay, so next topic, topological field theory. Now, the conformal field theory as I've written this is too difficult to work with. It's a very complicated quantum field theory. And you can make some statements about it, but it really is nice if we can make a slightly modified version of the conformal field theory, which is much easier to analyze. And that's the purpose behind so-called topological field theory. And the idea is that I take the n equals 2 comma 2 theory that I started with, and the first thing I do is re-identify some of the fields. So if you remember, this was a section of etc. So I had my world shape fermions. I'm going to now modify the identification of these fermions to be something slightly different. So instead, let's say this was a section. So I'm going to remove the fact that it depended on the canonical bundle. I'm going to put all of the canonical bundle into the anti-holomorphic component. Okay. So instead of having half in psi I and half in psi I bar, I've moved everything down into psi I. And this is known as twisting. This, the way that I've moved this half power of k totally into one side is called twisting, and this is going to be called the plus twist. But of course, I could do it the other way around. Or, there's no reason why I can't write down another theory, which is k sigma times so that's going to be called the minus twist. And I'm doing this for the left-moving fermions, psi L. And I can do it for the right-moving fermions. Now, this gives me four theories, which I can call plus, 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 minus, minus, plus, minus, minus. Okay. Now, as I mentioned, the difference between a holomorphic and a but the difference between an I and an I bar is basically a choice of the sign of my current J. So another way of thinking about these signs I've given is somehow the way that I'm identifying things with my worldsheet current, the sign of my worldsheet current JL and JR. So the difference between this and this is a change in sign of the left moving worldsheet current. Here I take it to be what it is. If I change its sign, I get this. Now, if you remember earlier, I said that complex conjugation was a bit like changing the sign of the worldsheet current. The plus plus theory is actually simply the complex conjugate. Of the minus minus theory, and the plus minus theory is simply the complex conjugate of the minus plus theory. So of these four theories I've written down, there are only actually two different ones which are interesting. Going between plus plus and minus minus and going between plus minus and minus plus is simply taking the complex conjugate of my target space. So let me give two names to the theories. I'm going to call one A and one B. And at the moment, this A and B has nothing to do with the D-brain A and B. But of course, they're going to be tied together. These are going to be my two topological field theories. There's the A-type topological field theory and the B-type topological field theory, which are got from the original N equals 2 theory by just re-identifying what these fermions do, the way that they live on the world sheet. And let me write down a definition. If the A model of this theory, so if I write down my quantum field theory associated to maps of sigma into X is equivalent. Now, as mathematicians, you'll say, what does that mean? What's equivalent mean? I mean that the operator product is isomorphic between these two theories. Of another Calabi-Yau Y, then X and Y are mirror Calabi-Yau. Now, this is the original definition of what mirror means. Well, I guess it's not. It's entirely equivalent to what the original definition of what mirror means. I guess this came about 2 years after the original definition. Now, I'm going to try and finish by 1:30, by the way, I guess I'm supposed to. There are two steps to building a topological quantum field theory. The first thing I do is to re-identify some of the worldsheet fermions. And the second thing I do is to restrict my theory to a subset of fields. Now, let me describe what this restriction process looks like. So the original theory had supersymmetries. On the world sheet. In particular, a generator of a supersymmetry is a fermion. Now, I've re-identified what my fermions are doing. My psis are no longer fermions in the sense that they live in some kind of spinner bundle. I've replaced the bundle that they live in. So instead, I have, let me call them zero forms and one forms. And my supersymmetries are like half forms. I've taken my two half forms, turned one into a zero form and one into a one form. Now, a zero form that looks like a fermion, i.e. this is called a BRST symmetry. And I'm going to call it Q. And my other one form, I'm going to call G, just like I called the original supersymmetries, but that G is now one form and not a spinner. Now, how can I make this quick? So let me quickly write down the example. So EG in the A model . So let me replace the symbol psi with the symbol chi to represent the scalar. Sorry? Right, these psis, which were originally spinners on the worksheet, I'm going to make half of them zero forms and half of them one forms on sigma. That's a zero form.
Talking about the charge or the current?
The current.
Well, the current doesn't count. The current is a one form.
Okay, it might be. It's the charge. Yeah. It's the operator which I'm going to apply. It's the operator I'm going to use as the BRST operator. Which should better be a zero form. It takes. Right. Okay. Okay. So I've got my psis with going to chi, so I've got the other ones. Let me put a subscript z. So this is the twisting in this direction. These are one forms. Well, by that I mean that the one form looks like. Well, this kind of thing. And then my. This should definitely answer what your question is now. My transform that was my supersymmetry now looks like this. So this is how my fields change under the symmetry generated by the BRST transformation. Where the idea is that a change in any operator, so if X is an operator, I can induce that change in the operator by taking an anti-commutator with Q. Okay, so that's the way that I get my BRST symmetry. I take the anti-commutator, it induces some change, which is labeled by some fermion alpha, and this is the way that those fields change. This is the A model, yeah. I won't do the details of B. Hopefully I can get to the end of the A. Now, suppose we consider. Now, this is where the magic of the twist comes in. At the moment, you think, well, why did I do this crazy twist? Why did I reinterpret these spinners? If we consider only those operators for which
the anti-commutator with Q is zero,
then any correlation function in the quantum field theory is invariant under a shift either I can change x by q of something, or a similar shift of the action. Now that's why it's called a top. Yeah. Sorry?
Is it anti-commutator for bosonic
X? No, it's probably commutator for bosons and anti-commutator. Yeah, it's the graded commutator. Yeah. So if I shift either X by basically Q of something, or I shift the action by Q of something, it'll have no effect on the correlation function. And that's why it's called the topological field theory. There's nothing to do with homeomorphisms here. It should be called a homotopic theory or something rather than a topological field theory. And that any kind of deformation which looks like this, the interesting stuff in the field theory will not change. And that's what makes these theories so simple to analyze. So there are two steps in taking a topological field theory. The first step is to replace the fermions by something different. The fermions change to zero forms and one forms. And the second step is to restrict only to the operators such that Q on the operator is zero. So I look at a very small subset of all possible operators in this theory. So this very small quantum field theory which I end up with is very nice to analyze. And that's what we're going to be interested in. Okay. Now, in the A model, the model that I've just written down, certainly moving, so changing a complex structure of X can be shown to change S by Q of something. In other words, changing the complex structure of X doesn't make any difference to correlation functions. As far as the topological field theory is concerned, this is a trivial change. The A model doesn't know what the complex structure of the target space is. Changing, let me say B plus IJ, I'm going to use this notation all the time. B plus IJ is the combination of the Kähler form and the B field. J is the Kähler form. This is going to be in, well, to be precise, I should put a star there. That's my complex object, B plus IJ. This does matter. In fact, when I get to the later lectures, that's going to be very important, the fact that size matters. B plus IJ will change things. And we can do everything that we did with the A model, we can now do with the B model. This analysis, by the way, is fairly old. This goes back to Witten back in 1991, who was the first person to analyze it in terms of topological field theory. So I could write down similar kinds of things for the B model. I won't bore you with the details. But the main thing you find is that the complex structure and the B plus IJ swap, changing B plus IJ shifts the action by Q or something and is therefore trivial.
whereas changing a complex structure matters. Okay? Yeah. A Calabi-Yau threefold. Yeah. A Calabi-Yau threefold, I'll make sure that it doesn't have any holomorphic two forms. So B is guaranteed to be a type 1-1. So a Calabi-Yau threefold, as far as I'm concerned, its holonomy really is SU3. It's not a subgroup of SU3. Okay. That's how we're doing. So, so let me just close by mentioning how we can add in the D brains now. I've written down two different topological field theories, one with an A twist, one with a B twist. I would like to add in my D brains. Now, the problem with adding in the D brains was that I cut down the amount of Wolschewitz supersymmetry that I've been playing with. So I can't necessarily add my D brains in a consistent way to the to the way that I've twisted the topological field theories. But it turns out in the A model, I can actually add the A brain, and in the B model, I can add the B brain. The way that we define the A brain is entirely consistent with the way that I've defined the A topological field theory. In particular, one thing I should emphasize was that when I wrote down the BRST symmetry, I was combining both the left-moving and the right-moving supersymmetry. If you notice, I'm saying that I'm treating the left-moving sector and the right-moving sector in the same way. So the fact that I identified the left-moving supersymmetries with the right-moving supersymmetries is fine. I just have to worry about the relative signs of the J's which I imposed. And indeed, the relative signs of the J's work out perfectly for the A brain in the A model, and they work out perfectly for the B brain in the B model. And that's probably a good place to stop. We'll carry on there tomorrow. Absolutely right. Right, so what I did, it looked like I've invented a completely new theory. So it's another step, which I didn't do, to show you that the correlators that you get from the new theory are in fact the same as the correlators of those fields that you've chosen to keep in the first theory. I didn't mention that step, but it turns out to be true. Okay, fine, yeah. Right. But there are certainly some correlators which are different between the two theories. But if you look at the right operators, then it's the same in both theories.